Okay, I'm still hesitating which version of this talk to give. Does anybody care about real data here? Yes, okay, good. So let's go with this talk. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about two things that normally sort of, well, one thing that definitely people feel a little bit uncomfortable sometimes in quantitative sciences, which is prediction, as in terms of prediction in time. And the other thing, which most physicists, computer scientists, and mathematicians are very afraid of, and in fact, most biologists, which is immune repertoires. So I'll try and sort of make both of these concepts friendly to you. And I'll talk about work we've been doing over a number of years now with Thierry Morin, who's also at DNS. And in the first part, which will be about data, we were joined by Yuval Quentin, Anand Zagan Kurt, and our Russian collaborators who provided the experimental data and some analysis. And in the second part, I'll talk about more theoretical work with Vijay and Andreas. Okay, but just to sort of start with the easier of the two concepts, maybe prediction. So prediction is everywhere in biological systems. This is Serena hitting, trying to hit a ball and probably succeeding, knowing her. But what she's doing involuntarily, she's actually integrating the equations of motion with the ball and translating it, the input, which is the ball, into the output, which is the mechanical motion of her arm, and trying to maximize information between the input at some time ago and the response at some later time, so some sort of delayed information while integrating the equations of motion. Another example of prediction is a bit more drastic, and it happens when the male moth has to find a female. So the male moth is born without a digestive system. It's born with energy. It's all the energy it has for its life, it's actually born with. And so that basically starts the clock ticking. And during this time, it has to find, well, fulfill its goal in life, which is to reproduce and find a female. And surprisingly, it succeeds. And it can actually do this up to the orders of a kilometer, a few kilometers away although it lives of the order of a day or two. So this is a hard task because it's actually doing it in real air in a turbulent environment. And we don't actually fully understand how it does it, but this sets a lot of people are thinking about it. And one idea that has been proposed is an algorithm for locating these sources in turbulent environments, which is to try and maximize the entropy reduction rate. So I think you've heard about entropy rates last week for those of you who came. But basically the idea is that what the MOV is doing in the head, or at least then, you know, somebody doing this kind of algorithm, is that on one hand, it's doing a mixture of exploitation and exploration. So with exploration, it's gathering data and building a probabilistic map in its head. And with exploitation, it's doing a maximum likelihood search, trying to go down in this map that it's built. And altogether, what it's actually doing is it's moving in the direction of smaller entropy, so smaller uncertainty about where the source is coming from. So it's not just going directly to where it thinks the source is coming from, but it's doing a probabilistic search. Another example of prediction is what we do as scientists, and this is from my colleagues Marta Uksa and Michael Lessig. So every year, we as humanity try and predict what will be the next year's main flu strain so that we can build vaccines and have time to build vaccines. This happens for the Northern Hemisphere. It happens in February of every year. The WHO gets together and they decide on a vaccine. This is data from flu strains for a given year. And you can see the prediction happens here. And it turns out that, again, by putting together sort of our knowledge, a probabilistic framework with equations for evolution and data about existing strains, they were able to make predictions for what the next year's flu strain will be. Those are the dashed lines, and the solid lines are actually what happened later. So for a few months, these kinds of predictions, although the system is very complex, are possible. If we integrate our knowledge of some dynamics within a probabilistic framework. So sort of encouraged by our colleagues, we asked ourselves a similar question of, can our organism predict future viruses that will attack us, and can it be prepared for it? So the idea is that we have an immune system, we have an adaptive immune system, which I'll tell you a little bit more about, but it's made out of T and B cells, which are basically cells that have receptors on the surface that recognize foreign pathogens. And if we have a certain composition of these cells that are protecting us against pathogens right now, and this works fairly well, how should this composition of cells change in the future to protect us against against the pathogens that we'll see in the future? Can we basically think of our own immune systems as systems that are trying to predict the statistics of future pathogens and reorganize themselves in a way for that to function? And I'd just like to point out that this task of doing it within our own body is much harder than what they did here, because first of all, we don't have all of this information. We don't have the information from all the worldwide circulating strains. We just have the information that actually of what our own body encountered. But we can still, but on the other hand, if our immune system is to function and is to protect us against many different pathogenic threats, it should be somehow matched to the statistics of the environment, so the viral strains that are circulating. So that's what I'd like to go. But first of all, let me tell you a little bit more about how the immune system functions and why does it work statistically. So as I said, I'll be talking about the adaptive immune system made out of B and T cells. We'll mainly focus on T cells for the first part of the talk, but the story is exactly the same for B cells. These are cells, they have a receptors of the surface, and the point of this receptor is to recognize a pathogen and trigger an immune response. Now, the way this is set up by nature is that one cell has many receptors, but they're all of each type. So to get many different receptors, you need many different cell types. And you need many different receptors because you have many different pathogens. So to recognize different pathogens, you need different kinds of receptors. It's not a one-to-one mapping, as we'll get into later, but generally receptors are specialized for some kinds of pathogens. So at the end of the day, we need diversity of receptors, so we need diversity of cells. Is that clear? To those of you that haven't heard about it, good, okay. So what we were interested in is characterizing what is the diversity of these immune receptors in what we'll call a normal individual. So somebody who's generally healthy, of course, doesn't have serious autoimmune disorders, of course, gets sick from time to time, like all of us do. And so what I'll show you today is trying to get at the question of how diverse it is, and then thinking about the repertoires as possible predictors. Okay, so we have of the order of 10 to the 9th different T cells. So where do these 10 to the 9th different T cell receptors come from? Well, they're generated in a very funky way by combining combinatorics and randomness to generate diversity. So the way this works is simplifying a little bit for the experts, but each receptor is made out of three parts, V, D, and J. And in our genome, so in the DNA in every single cell in our body, we have some genomic templates for each one of these parts. So some number of templates for V, some number of templates for D, and J. And then the DNA in our T cells actually gets edited, and you pick one V1, D1J, and you throw away the rest. Okay, so you actually edit DNA, so now our T cells and B cells actually have a different, slightly different DNA composition than all of our cells. And if you multiply these numbers, you get a roughly of the order of 1,000 different combinations. We have to get to 10 to the 9th. So then enzymes come along, and then the junctions between the V and the D and the D and the J randomly insert and delete nucleotides. So you basically put these three blocks together like words, and then you take some scissors and glue, and you put in and take out anything you want. And so if you do that, you can easily imagine that you're going to make up a sequence that will not, that will be of a different length, and specifically will not be in frame. So now when I try to read it out, I try to make protein, it won't make protein because there'll be a stop codon, or there'll be some other problem. And that happens, okay? But remember, we have two chromosomes. So if this happens on the first one, well, if the first one rearranges in a way that looks okay, that's fine, you stop. But if it happens on the first one that it gives this out-of-frame sequence, it gets silenced and you move on to the second one. If it also happens to the second one, well, that's a problem. You have to silence, you kill the cell to simplification. But if the second one is okay and the first one isn't, you're going to have a cell that if you now go in and look at its DNA, you're going to see both of these rearranged receptors, only one of them will be functional, but the first one will not. So if you look at the ones from the first one, you can actually learn the statistics of this generation process, not worrying about anything else that happened to these cells downstream. Okay, and there's various selection processes I'll mention later that happen, but if we look at these, we don't have to worry about that, and that's what we're gonna do. Okay, so then, as I said, the selection and this leads to what we call the naive repertoire, which is the first functional repertoire. So through immune repertoire sequencing techniques, we can actually now go in. You can go in. You can volunteer yourself if you feel like it. They'll happily take your blood, sort out the T cells, and sequence it. And this is for the experts. We're going to be looking at different data sets from Harlan Robbins and Dmitry Chudakov's lab. For the experts, this is a little bit different than normal genomic sequencing because it's done all in one row. So you sequence the V gene, this variable region, which is called CDR3, and most of the J region. But you basically you don't do shotgun sequencing and align reads, and if you look at the reads, you do see that some percentage of them are out of frame, so this corresponds to these, and the rest are in frame, which can either correspond to that or that. So it's, and from the out of frame, we can learn something about generation, and from the others, we can learn something about selection. Okay, so how do we do this? So remember, this is just a reminder of the scheme. We get sequences, and what we want to know is we want to calculate the probability of you generating any T cell receptor. So you can play a little game, you can take a piece of paper, you can write down any combination of the four letters that make up nucleotides, and then we can ask what's the probability that your body actually generated that T cell receptor. That's the level we're going to try to get at. And we're going to do it from these out-of-frame sequences. So if this is a sequence we see in the data, the simplest thing we could try to do is we could try and align it with these genomic templates. So find the most likely V, the most likely D, and the most likely J. But if we do that, because of the insertions and deletions, we'll never find one scenario that corresponds that we're certain is the way a given sequence was produced, because I could have deleted and inserted more or less anything I want. So what we're going to do is we're going to do this probabilistically. So we're going to make a library of all possible scenarios, by which I mean the choice of V, D, and J gene and number of insertions and deletions that is consistent with a given sequence. And we do it for all sequences. We assign weights to these scenarios, and then we use these weights to calculate the marginal distributions. So calculate the mean probability of using a given V gene, D gene, having a certain number of insertions and deletions, and so on. And then we put this together in a model, which is the most general factorizable model. And then we use it to recalculate these weights. And we do this self-consistently until it converges. If you're a physicist, if you're a computer scientist, we implement an expectation maximization procedure to do this. But at the end of the day, we learn the elements of these of the model, which gives us the probability of the weights, so the probability of any of these scenarios leading to that sequence, and then we sum over. We sum these weights over all the scenarios to calculate the probability of actually generating any sequence. So at the end of the day, we now know what's the probability that your body generated any T cell receptor. This is what the elements of the model look like. This is the the histogram of the number of insertions. And what you see here in the solid lines, probably the most interesting thing about it are the error bars. So bearing in mind, this is data coming from 9 real people. Now we've looked at many more. But the error bars, so in blue you see the VD insertions and in red the DJ insertions, so the two junctions. And the error bars are over 9 real people. So basically, you see this process is incredibly reproducible. And it doesn't matter who you are, your insertion profile essentially looks the same way. The dashed lines are what you would get if you would take the best scoring scenario for each sequence. So the ones that so there's always a best scoring one, which is essentially what you would get if you did a deterministic assignment, and it shows you get the spurious peak, which shouldn't be there. So the other thing to notice about this, so if we now take the if we look at the sequences in your body and we calculate the probability of generating a single one of them, well, we calculate the probability of generation for all of them and we make a histogram. So we basically ask, how many sequences do you have that have an overall probability to be generated? That's 10 to minus 10, 10 to the minus 12, 10 to the minus 15, and so on. You get a histogram like that. And you see that it spans 20 orders of magnitude. So you have some sequences that are relatively likely to be produced, but some that are really, really unlikely. So with this now in hand, we can start asking questions about the naive repertoire. We can also characterize selection in a very similar way, and then we can start asking how many sequences do you and I share? So any two people in the world, we can take people for which we have data, and we can say how many sequences are actually identical to the nucleotide in person one and person two. So in you and me, for example. And we can do that because now we have a random expectation. So we know how many sequences you produce, what's the probability that you produce a sequence and it passes selection, and you know what's the probability that I produce a sequence and it passes selection. In fact, if the model is universal, which I'm claiming it is, I can show you more details if you're interested, then that's just the square of the probability of generation times the probability of passing selection. That's what's on this axis. And we can compare to what we see in data, and you see that it's very close to random expectations. This was relatively preliminary data. You can say, well, two people, okay, you know, maybe it's a fluke, maybe you got lucky, maybe whatever. So we asked, can we predict how many receptors actually shared in over 700 people? And so this is the number of shared people as a function of number of people sharing. So how many people share 2 receptors, 3 receptors, and so on up until 764 or something. And you see the data is the crosses and the model prediction, again, done in this basically squaring, well, nth-ing these factors is in red. So we can predict how many unique receptors you and essentially anybody else in the world will share, and it doesn't matter whether you know this person, are related to them, or how much soy milk the two of you drank together. Basically, it's just a biochemical process encoded in us that generates this. Okay? The only exception to this is if you happen to have an identical twin. Anybody has an identical twin? Probably not in a room this size with this age distribution. But if you do, then you can consider yourself special because you do share more sequences with that identical twin. I can tell you later why. Okay. Anyway, we can also look at outliers from these distributions to link them to some conditions. I won't go into that. I'll now skip to this is to sort of give you, first of all, to establish some street cred that you don't think I'm some crazy person just talking about prediction. And I've never really looked at the real immune repertoire. I've looked at immune repertoires. But also to just sort of give you an idea of what data in this field looks like. But let's move on to the sort of more predicting part. And so while we've been talking about this, if we want to predict future states of pathogens, we have to ask ourselves, well, what do pathogens do? Well, mostly pathogens move around a lot. So this is the transition matrix of the flu. This is how the flu travels. This is data from Trevor Bedford at the Fred Hutch. These are major airline routes. So you see the flu travels by plane. Yet another reason not to take the plane. But it travels a lot. So that's the main thing we're going to have in our model. For now, we're just going to assume that... for now, we're just going to assume, that viruses are going to move from place to place. That's going to be the main source of change. And so what do we really mean when we say prediction? So far when I talked about data, I mainly talked about unique sequences. Now I'm going to add another layer to the problem. Actually, when immune receptors are in your body, when they encounter a pathogen, they proliferate. They make many copies of themselves, and this starts making clones. So if we then take into account how frequent a given receptor is in a given person, we can look at these frequency rank distributions. So we take the most common receptor, put it up here, second most common, and so on, and this is its frequency. So these are human T cells, and you see these very long-tailed distributions. You see them also for B cells in fish. You see them basically everywhere else. So what the name of the game in predicting is being prepared. Well, you have to be prepared for everybody, but since you want to use this distribution of receptors you have at your disposal to have receptors here that are going to match the pathogens you're likely going to encounter. So can you use this distribution to try and infer frequencies? And of course, the problem of estimating frequencies is a problem that's out there in a lot of systems that we now look at in the microbiome, in ponds, also it's a problem that goes back to the Middle Ages and trying to predict the number of different species the king had in his forest. But basically, prediction in the setting is linked to estimating frequencies. And what allows us to make predictions? The only reason that we can make predictions is because what we're trying to predict, so in this case, the pathogens, their evolution is correlated in time. So the flu species we have now, is related to the flu species we had a year ago in some sense, or was around a year ago. These things have a continuous distribution. There's some sort of continuous dynamics here, and that's what allows for prediction. If things were completely uncorrelated, we'd have no chance of prediction. And that's what we're going to try and exploit. Can we exploit the correlations and the dynamics of the environment, in this case the pathogens, to change the behavior of our sensory system, which is the immune system? Now, the other thing you need for prediction is memory. So even if there's correlations in what you're trying to predict, but you have no memory, you're not going to get very far. Right? So you need to be able to remember. Luckily, the immune system has a potential for memory. It's called the memory repertoire. So the way this works is once you've encountered a pathogen, you proliferate, you make many copies of yourself, and after the infection is cleared, some small fraction of these proliferated cells get set aside, given a flag, which more or less means you've seen a pathogen, and get put into a separate subcompartment called that has its own homeostasis, regulates its own size, called the memory repertoire. So one question we can ask, well, if we're asking the question, is the immune system trying to predict? So is having memory useful? And the second question is, if you do have memory, what's the best way you should try to update it? Should you do a proportional update, meaning every time you see a pathogen, whether it's the first, second, or fifth time you see it, you always generate two receptors and then you just accumulate this memory? Or should you have a memorated memory update that maybe the first time you get overexcited and generate, you know, two receptors, but the third time you only generate one and the fifth time you don't do anything, or the other way around, if it's the second time you generate more and the fifth time you generate even more. So you can imagine the different scenarios. So what is the best way to do it? Okay, so with those elements in mind, we're trying to estimate frequencies given a correlated environment and the fact that we have memory. This is how we're going to set up the problem. So we have some pathogen distribution, which we're going to call Q of T. And pathogens evolve according to some dynamics, some dynamical operator, which I'm going to call A. You can imagine any kind of dynamics you want. As I said, we used the dynamics where we just had them hop around in the space they're allowed to live with some Wright-Fisher type of dynamics, so with stochasticity. So that's team one. Team two is the receptor distribution, which we're going to call P of T. And the name of the game is for the receptor distribution, for the receptors to recognize the pathogens. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to minimize the cost, the expected cost of an infection. So the cost given a given distribution and a given pathogen environment at a given time. We want to minimize it and find the optimal immune repertoire given the pathogen distribution. So the only problem is we don't actually know what the pathogen distribution is, right? Here we're back to what I was talking about in the beginning, that unlike us at the computer with all the worldwide data of the flu, our organism doesn't have that. We don't know what's out there. I mean, I'm not even saying that us with the data knows the whole environment, the whole pathogen distribution, but it's way more than our organism actually knows. So if we don't know Q, we need to estimate it. And so that's what we're going to postulate. We're going to postulate that our organism keeps a belief in the technical sense of the word, not the metaphysical sense of the word. So it keeps a meta distribution over the distribution of pathogen frequencies. Okay, it seems it keeps some belief, which it propagates forward in time. So it basically has some idea of what the possible distributions of pathogens could be. Okay, if there's no encounter, then it evolves this belief according to the same dynamics. We're going to assume that on evolutionary timescales, we've learned the dynamics according to which pathogens evolve, and it's just going to propagate it forward. But when an encounter occurs, so when our organism encounters a pathogen, then there's a collapse of part of this belief, because now you know exactly what's the frequency of that pathogen. So you no longer have to say, okay, the frequency of that pathogen is chosen from this distribution, but it collapses in that point, and we know exactly what it is. So there's a sort of update of the prior belief to the posterior, which you then propagate forward. And so when that happens, what that corresponds to is a proliferation event, because you mount a response, and then your memory repertoire gets changed, and then you can propagate this forward in time. So basically, we're saying that this prediction happens through a mixture of encounters and having this prior belief, which is possible based on the memory repertoire. That's the basic idea. Is that clear, more or less? All right. So the only thing I haven't told you is what's the cost. I said there's a cost. We can write this out explicitly. So, you know, now that we know we're estimating the cost, we're actually estimating it over the belief distribution, but we need to actually put some function in here. So we're going to assume that both our pathogens and our receptors, they live in an effective recognition space. This is an idea that goes back in immunology to Perelson and the idea of shape space, but if that helps you, that's good. If you've never heard of it, don't worry. It's basically an idea that there's a space where both pathogens and receptors live, and if you're close, if they're close together in this space, they're likely to recognize each other, and if they're far away in this space, they're less likely to recognize each other. And you can define any measure you want. It can be, it can be just the simplest way to think about it is sort of like this: that you have a space which is, you know, say, 2D. A 2D space, and you have a receptor here, and all the pathogens in this blue cloud can be recognized by this receptor. The ones that are closer to it get recognized more strongly, the one that gets further less strongly, until they stop being recognized when the cloud goes away. So you can think about these little Gaussians covering space. And then if you have the red receptor, same thing, it can recognize things here. But then there's pathogens in the middle that can be recognized less weakly than the ones closer to the center of this, but they can be recognized by both of these receptors, okay? And you can think about covering space in this way. So we function in this effective recognition space. And we're going to say that the probability of an antigen, of a specific antigen being recognized by any receptor, is just given by the probability of each receptor recognizing it, time multiplied, weighted by these little Gaussians. I mean, that they don't have to be Gaussians. I'm just saying Gaussians because that's usually how people think about little things that look like that. Anyway, so you sum over all the receptors weighted by how well they can recognize them. We're going to measure time in the mean number of encounters, and then we're going to encode this intuition that if a pathogen appears, then your immune system is trying to find the right receptor for it. But as time goes, you know, it may try and may fail. As time goes by and you're not recognizing the pathogen, basically you're not getting any healthier. So the cost of infection increases with the time to recognition until recognition actually happens. And so the way we're going to encode this is that we're going to say that there's a Poisson distribution of recognition events, and then there's some effective cost function, which is generally non-decreasing. It doesn't have to increase, but it can plateau after a certain while. And then we're going to integrate over the recognition, the encounters, to find the total cost coming from one pathogen given a given receptor distribution. And there's a virulence-free factor depending on how quickly you may want to do this. So this is for one antigen, one pathogen. Antigen, pathogen is the same thing in this context. And then we have to sum over all possible pathogens for the cost from each pathogen for over the given distribution at the given time from the antigens. And that gives us our overall cost. Then we just have to minimize it. Okay, so having set up the problem, we can now go back and ask the question of whether actually having memory helps you. So what we're going to do is we're going to calculate the relative cost compared to not having memory and not trying to do the prediction as a function of how often you encounter pathogens. And we're going to look at environments of different sparseness. So sparseness, remember, this is why it's important to think about this affective space. Sparseness is just how the, you know, in how many parts of this you can think about this as some sort of 2D square. Do you have pathogens, and then how many places you don't? So you see that, first of all, as your rate of encountering pathogens increases, your cost increases. So first of all, first thing to see is that, yes, prediction helps. It helps more the more you encounter pathogens, but it's also much easier to, the cost decreases much more quickly in sparse environments. So it's good to be in a sparse environment where you're essentially just trying to detect a few key pathogens. And of course, the faster they change, the harder it gets. So if the pathogen environment changes quickly, then your cost goes down more slowly. But what's remarkable is that there are all these parameters here, is how fast the environment changes, sparseness, and how many pathogens you have, but it all collapses onto one curve. All of these curves can collapse onto one master curve, which is basically the cost just scales as the number of sampled non-negligible pathogens, so different pathogens. And the only two parameters that really matter are the sparseness parameter and the sampling parameter. And this is reminiscent of compressive sensing when you're trying to reproduce a sort of a complex set of data. And if the problem is sparse and you sample enough, you're going to manage. So it seems that sparseness is really important here. And so what are the consequences of sparseness? So one of the consequences is that it helps us understand how can we learn a lot of different pathogens in our lifetime, even though, you know, we're probably not sampling. So this is an order of estimate that comes from sort of complicated sources. It's not necessarily something to be taken extremely seriously. The only thing that matters here is that it's a big number. So we probably don't, I mean, we actually don't know how many pathogens we encounter, but we probably don't encounter so many very different pathogens. But, you know, how can we learn an environment of this complexity? And the answer is we can learn it if it's sparse. So in a typical, when we get an infection, the increase in the memory, the size of the memory repertoire is typically 100 to 1,000 fold. So our theory, this is a prediction of our theory, which sort of suggests that the environments that we live in have an inverse sparseness parameter of about 10 to the 6. Okay, so this gives us this kind of sparseness. If we multiply it by this and go back to the previous graph and read it off, that basically gives us a prediction to be over here of about a half. So that means, sorry, that gives us a k alpha t kt over of the order of 1, which means that it reduces our cost twofold. So a pathogen seen once in a sparse environment will give us the twofold cost decrease. So that's a very, very, very good. And what that tells us is that what could be happening is that since it's a sparse environment, where it's actually very easy to learn these global features of the distribution, and that seems to be happening when we're young. So this is again a prediction of our theory for the memory fraction as a function of age in human years. And this is what's sort of a composite from what we see in data. And what cartoon composite, and we see that the memory fraction goes up very quickly and then plateaus, the same way as it does in Afferi. And as the memory fraction goes up, the pathogen susceptibility goes up. And what we think is happening here is basically we're learning the sparse features, the easy features, the sort of big landmarks in the environment, and then we slow down once we've done that, and we have to sort of fill in the details, and learning gets more complicated. So these are consequences of living in a sparse environment. And the other thing, so if we go back to this question of memory management that I sort of started off with, is that the answer is that the theory predicts a modulated memory response. Meaning if this is the response during the first infection, the response during subsequent infections with the same pathogen, the memory repertoire produced is smaller and smaller in each. So we have negative feedback. And a direct consequence of this negative feedback is what we see during vaccination. So if we look at the pre-vaccination response to a hemagglutinin titer, so a titer, a pathogen, an antigen linked with flu, so we see that there's the ones that were before vaccinating with the flu, they were already very responsive, and then the ones that were not very responsive over here. And then we look at the fault change after vaccination with the flu vaccine, and we see the ones that were already very responsive, they don't go up much, but the ones that were not very responsive, they go up a lot. So that's a direct encoding of this feedback. These are the data points. The line is not the fit. It's actually, it's a prediction of the model with this element of the feedback. If you didn't have a modulated response, if you had always responded with the same number of memory cells, you would not get this kind of prediction. You'd get a straight line. And in fact, this feedback is also compatible, so you can translate it into dynamics for immune cells. You can translate it into a dynamics where the receptors compete for antigens, so you can write down the dynamics which is compatible with this feedback and comes out of the predictions, so we can actually then figure out what this optimal update rule should be and what dynamics it corresponds to. And it turns out that it's dynamics that has been for a long time considered in the field what is happening in these immune repertoires. Again, if we didn't have this negative feedback, we would not get this kind of dynamics. And then you may be worried, okay, but you know, how are we sure that we can actually learn? We know we have the right prior. And it turns out that it really doesn't matter. So you can expand the prior and encode it in basically your expectation of how often you're going to see a given pathogen. And if you get it right or wrong, so this one is the right one, these ones are all wrong ones, it really doesn't matter. The cost decrease as a function of sampling is still good. Okay, so what do these repertoires actually look like? If we take a given fixed pathogenic environment, we can, you know, we solve the problem numerically, we can actually look at it. This is a 1D representation of this recognition space. So at every position we can put a pathogen with different frequencies, and that's what the blue line is. So it's a random pathogen distribution. The green lines is the result of the optimization, is what the optimal repertoire looks like. So you see that it's peaked and it covers space. And then the red line is the repertoire coverage, is how much you can be protect. This green repertoire protects you against this blue distribution. And you see that you get essentially perfect coverage everywhere, although you know you have these receptors distributed in very discrete ways. So I mean, the reason you can do this, of course, is because of this cross-reactivity. If you have a receptor here, you're covered everywhere here, and how often the space depends on this cross-reactivity. But again, if you're a computer scientist, you're maybe not surprised by that. We often get discrete solutions, for example, when we optimize information in bounded spaces, we get discrete solutions. But here, the reason is really due to this cross-reactivity, and this generalizes to higher dimension. This is the speckled pattern if we looked at two-dimensional recognition space. Okay. Then we can ask the question of, so what does this mean for me personally? So if we're here in the same room and we're in the same environment, we're sampling the same environment, and if we ask, so you say you're sampling your individual blue and I'm individual yellow, and this is how we're sampling the pathogenic environment here. We're sampling slightly different versions of the environment. The question is, should we both have the same optimal immune systems or different ones? The answer is we should have different ones, or we will have different ones. So these are our two optimal immune systems. And the similarity between our optimal immune systems goes down as a function of how differently we see the environment. Although the environments we're seeing are still very similar, and we both have perfect protection against the environment. So what's going on? Well, again, basically this combination of discreteness and cross-reactivity takes care of us, that you can have an immune repertoire like this, and I can have one like this, and from afar, we're both covering space. But I drew the grid lines to show you that our receptors are not placed at exactly the same positions, because it really doesn't matter, because cross-reactivity, so these little Gaussians, will take care of everything and will basically cover space for us. So this tells us that we can have very different solutions to the same problem. We can have very different phenotypic solutions, because this is a phenotypic description, which also means we can have very different genotypic solutions, right? So when I talked about data, I talked about the genotype, I talked about the sequence encoding. So we went from the genotype now to the phenotype, so the phenotype is really what matters, but of course there's many ways of encoding the same phenotype by the genotype. So if I already am telling you that at the phenotypic level we can have many different solutions, that means at the genotype level we can have even more solutions. So we shouldn't be surprised if we look at this graph. Of course, it depends on how deep we sample, exactly what the numbers are, but you see that the numbers of receptors we share are relatively small. This is from a sample of the order of 10 to the 6 sampled cells, we're sharing a few thousand, so it's a very small fraction. Most of them are different because mostly we find the different solutions to the same problem, and they're all equally good. Okay, so I wanted to show you a little bit about the system that is incredibly complex in many ways, stochastic, combines combinatorics, randomness to produce something that's functional, but we can still learn the rules, and we can learn the rules in a predictive sense as long as we learn them stochastically. So there are some stochastically encoded rules. And then going with the idea of how far we can push predictions that are Bayesian and stochastic, we tried to look at the immune system from that perspective and show that you can reproduce some features of that are seen in data, and one of the things that we think is going on is that we actually live in a sparse pathogenic environment, which allows us to build these discrete, disordered, and random solutions to different solutions to protect us against it. Okay, thank you.